I think what I'd like to do is have you turn to 2 Samuel chapter 11 and there's an outline in your notes if you want to follow what I'm doing on David's catastrophic sin. I've got a couple of outlines about David's sin. We're tempted by many different things. Some people are tempted, we're going to talk about substance abuse, drunkenness, drug use. Some people are tempted by sexual lust of different kinds. Some people are tempted to anger, outbursts of anger. Some people are tempted to covetousness and overspending. And we're even having a workshop this time on hoarding as a growing problem with the ease of shopping online. Temptation tends to follow the same pattern no matter what the temptation is. And it's stated in James chapter 1, if you will actually keep your finger in 2 Samuel. James says in verse 13 of chapter 1, "Let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted by evil, and he himself does not tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust. Then when lust is conceived, it gives birth to sin. And when sin is accomplished, it brings forth death." And this example of David, and you could take many other examples, but this is the most famous and one of the most clear, illustrates how temptation happens. And on one level, it's one of the saddest chapters in the entire Bible, especially since, you know, I've been going through 1 and 2 Samuel for quite a while in preaching, and the people of Israel are looking for a leader. They're looking for a great man of God to lead the nation, and Eli fails, especially because of his sons. Samuel seems okay, but then his sons are a failure. Saul becomes the king of the people, but he fails. And David looks like he's the real deal. David, up until now, just seems to do almost everything right. And then David falls in the most awful way. And yet, I'm also thankful this is here. The Bible is honest about its heroes, and you read about other men, Noah being drunk, and Abraham putting his wife at risk, his marriage at risk, her purity at risk, Peter denying Jesus. It serves as a warning that, back to 1 Corinthians 10:12, be careful if you think you stand lest you fall. You say, well, that could never happen to me. And maybe not that particular sin will happen to you, but sin can make tremendous inroads in the life of a real believer. And David was the real deal. He was really a believer who loved God. You read his Psalms. He was an amazing guy. That it's instructive of how we need to deal with temptation, which is why I'm talking with you about it. It also portrays sin accurately and along with its consequences. So Hollywood portrays sexual sin very glamorously. This passage portrays it along with how ugly and what the consequences are. Of course, also, it gives hope. Sometimes a counselee comes in. You know, she's had an abortion. They've gone through a divorce and a remarriage that was unbiblical and were sexually immoral. No matter what you've done, there's hope. If a murderer, adulterer, thief, and a liar can be saved, then God can save anybody. God can forgive anybody. And one other aspect that I think is important to mention is that in the context of 1 and 2 Samuel, that the failure of David shows us that no mere human ruler is ever going to do. David was given the covenant in 2 Samuel 7, where he was promised that there would be one of his sons who would sit on the throne forever. And David's not going to be that guy. And you keep reading in 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings is that it's going to take a man of an entirely different nature from David. to be the king the people of God need. Of course, that points us to Christ. But looking at the passage, I'm just going to read the first five verses. Then it happened in the spring, at the time when kings go out to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel. And they destroyed the sons of Ammon and besieged Rabbah. But David stayed at Jerusalem. Now when evening came, David arose from his bed and walked around on the roof of the king's house, and from the roof he saw a woman bathing. And the woman was very beautiful in appearance. So David sent and inquired about the woman, and one said, "Is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" David sent messengers and took her, and when she came to him, he lay with her. And when she had purified herself from uncleanness, she returned to her house. The woman conceived, and she sent and told David and said, "I am pregnant." First thing to notice here as it pertains to temptation is that in the context of 2 Samuel, David did not fall suddenly. And if you're paying careful attention up until now, you can see that there were harbingers to David's fall. It's kind of like sometimes you'll have a storm come through and a very big tree will have fallen. Think, well, it wasn't that big a storm. Winds were 20, 25 miles an hour. How could this giant tree fall? Well, sometimes they learn that it's been rotting from the inside, and it was only when the pressure came and it collapsed, you saw that the tree wasn't as big and strong as it appeared to be. And I think if you look at the life of David, he was rotting on the inside and had been for some time. David had a wrong view of marriage in that we know that he had acquired multiple wives. And rather than fulfilling God's design, which was, you know, God said, "It is not good for the man to be alone, I will make a helper suitable for him." And Jesus in Matthew 19, referring to this, said, "The two shall become one flesh." Well, you read in chapter 5, verse 13, it says, "David took more concubines and wives from Jerusalem after he came from Hebron, and more sons and daughters were born to David." And so, David, rather than fulfilling God's design up until now, finding one wife with whom he would be not just physically but emotionally intimate and one, instead is a polygamist, and that tends to view women really for two purposes. One is as a sex object and the other as a baby maker. And even as you see his attraction to Bathsheba, it wasn't like, "Boy, I would love to get to know her. I'm sure she's a godly woman." All he notices about her is her outward attractiveness. And he wants to add her to his harem. And really, that's the nature of all sexual promiscuity, is it's looking upon someone to gratify yourself rather than, according to God's design, is sex being an expression of a covenant and a oneness in every way. The Lord had explicitly forbidden kings to multiply wives. In Deuteronomy 17, it says, "He shall not multiply wives for himself, or else his heart will turn away." That's what other kings would do. That's what pagan kings would do, would be to have a massive harem and, you know, hundreds of sons or something like that. Also, it's interesting when this takes place in David's life. And again, if you've been studying the life of David, David has a hard life. I actually believe that David's life itself is in some sense a type of Christ, and that David was anointed to be the future king when he was a very young man, but he had suffering before glory. And I think when Jesus in Luke 24 says, "Don't you understand the Messiah has to suffer first?" I think David's life in a sense portrays that. It's that he is rejected, he's chased, he's hiding in caves, he's nearly dying. And David spends years and years of his life in a struggle for survival. And even when Saul dies, he has more years of struggle to gain the kingdom. Ironically, now David finally is at peace. Now the capital city has been captured. He's built himself a palace. There's a plan to build a temple in the next generation. The enemies, by and large, are subdued. The Rabbah is kind of just cleaning up the last of the mess of the neighbors. And David is in this position of security and power he'd never been before. And you say, well, when are you safer? Are you safer in the midst of trials, or are you safer when things are good? And the proverb says, give me neither poverty nor riches. If I'm rich, I may be tempted to forget God. That's Proverbs 30, verses 8 and 9. Another thing that scares me about David here is David was probably about 50. I'm about 50. And you know, you think, boy, if you could make it to 50, surely the youthful lusts would have died down by then and you'd be safe from a calamity like this. But he is not. Later in chapter 12, when Nathan confronts him, and chapter 12 is a study. And chapter 12, when Nathan confronts David and rebukes him, is really an interesting passage to study as well. It's kind of how nuthetic counseling works. And there's a lot there we can get from that. But when he admonishes David, he says in verse 7, thus says the Lord God of Israel, it is I who anointed you king over Israel. It is I who delivered you from the hand of Saul. I gave you your master's house, your master's wives. I gave you the house of Israel and Judah. If that had been too little, I would have added to you more than these. Why have you despised the word of the Lord? And David here, you know, what he's doing with Bathsheba is such an act of ingratitude. The Lord said, I've given you everything. How could you do this? And I think if you were to know, and we don't know for sure, but I doubt if David had written any Psalms lately. I think what he's saying is he had drifted from the Lord, drifted from the delight he had, even when the, you know, when he's dancing and rejoicing, when the Ark of the Covenant comes into his capital, it appears that his heart has grown cold. He's also guilty of neglecting his duty as king, verses 1 and 2. It says it's when kings go off to battle that he sends his underlings to go. And in the context of that time, in the rainy season, you couldn't fight. Now it's spring, go fight. Another little detail in verse 2, now when evening came, David arose from his bed. Does that sound good to you? It's not when I usually get up. In the evening, I don't know. But you see what happens to David. I read earlier James 1, that you have the same progression that takes place with him. And I want to emphasize, this isn't just sexual sin. You can use this pattern no matter what the sin may be. The person who's drunk, the person who's fearful, the person who's angry, the person who spends too much and runs up the credit cards. And James says, first of all, let no one say when he is tempted, I'm being tempted by God. You can't blame God. You can't say, well, God made me this way, so I couldn't help myself. You can't say, well, my husband was away. He was off in Iraq for 6 months, and I was lonely. Or, he was working overseas, and we're not together. Or, my wife's a cold fish, and so I don't have any affection at home. Or I was so provoked, I couldn't help myself but to hit that person or to take revenge. You are responsible. You can't blame God and say, well, I just have these strong passions. I just can't restrain whatever the passions may be. And then sin takes place not merely because of temptation from the outside, but from what's in our hearts. I'm not going to turn there again, but it's back to Mark 7, remember? When Jesus is not what comes at you from the outside that makes you sin, but it's what's in your heart. And there's always going to be temptation. It wasn't the outward temptation of seeing Bathsheba which caused David to sin. Rather, the temptation squeezed David's heart and showed the sin that was already inside. It's out of the heart, Jesus said, that adulteries and coveting and murder and theft come. So, David sees her. Verse 2, he sees the woman bathing, and that's lust conceived. Culturally, that scene is a little hard for us to picture. It'd be kind of like probably someone changing with the window shades open next door or something. They didn't have indoor plumbing with bathtubs back then, and so you'd have the roofs of the house. Even now in the Middle East, I've lived there, they're flat. And so there'd be things you'd do up there, and if it's hot, you'd get cool up there. And so, and I don't think she was like in one of these clawed bathtubs or something like Hollywood might represent. But some manner she was bathing, probably should have been more careful. But I don't think she was out there as a seductress. It appears even by the language it was the monthly cleansing a woman would have to do according to the law. And it says she was beautiful. Ironically, the word there is the same word used of David, at least when he was younger. But it's a warning that the Scripture warns about the lust of the eyes. In Bunyan's Holy War, it talked about the different gates of man's soul, and here's the eye gate. But it's not just sex. Remember Eve with the fruit? She saw the tree, that it was good for food and a delight to the eyes. And so, again, it can be the woman in the mall, and she sees the shoes that are a delight to the eyes, but not in her budget. But then David moves from looking to thinking. And so lust conceived. And somebody earlier questioned me about this analogy, well, I'm going to get to. But I think James's analogy is a very powerful one. In the same way that a baby is conceived in a womb, and if that embryo stays and is undisturbed, it's going to start growing. And what is initially invisible is going to multiply in size. And that's the picture that's happening here. Lust is conceived and is growing. And now David moves from merely thinking lustful thoughts to inquiring. He says, well, he inquired. He sent and inquired about her. Who is she? What should he have done? Should have looked away. Should have gone and found his own wife, if that's what he wanted. But this lust is conceived. And again, it's not just sex. A person, if you're angry in your heart and you allow that anger or that bitterness to grow within you, it's going to get bigger and bigger until it gives birth to sin. If you allow sinful worry and fear in your heart and thoughts that are unbelieving, that can grow until the act of sin or covetousness. Now, the answer David gets should have ended the discussion. It says, is this not Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite? She's a married woman. She's not eligible to be added to your harem, which is probably what David had in mind. Furthermore, her husband is one of your loyal soldiers, one of your mighty men. Right now, he's fighting for you against the Ammonites. And also, she's the daughter of one of your mighty men and the granddaughter of one of your key advisors, a guy named Ahithophel, who comes up later and joins in the rebellion. You wonder why Ahithophel joined Absalom's side. This might be one reason why. It's also a reminder that sexual immorality affects a lot more than two people, doesn't it? That when you touch someone else, you're not just touching them, you're touching their spouse, their kids, their parents, others all around them. But then, back to James, that lust conceived gives birth to sin. Verse 4, David sent messengers and took her, and when she came to him, he lay with her. And the conception in his heart, and this is the language I used that was disturbing earlier, but I'm going to use it, he should have aborted it. That's an abortion of which God approves. It's vivid language, and I mean it to be shocking language, but I think it fits with what James is saying. And instead of aborting the sin, he allows it to continue to grow, and he sins for her. And in doing this, and then it says he takes her. And this is the language when Nathan tells the parable of the ewe lamb, where you have this guy that has everything, and his poor neighbor has one little ewe lamb. He takes from his neighbor that one little ewe lamb and steals it. And David takes Bathsheba, steals her. He's become like Saul. Saul was the king who abused his power to get what he wanted. And David has become that guy. It could be a woman who misuses her beauty or a man who misuses his charm, his money, his power. Now, the description is very succinct. Hollywood wouldn't like this at all. Basically, he lay with her. That's the description. We don't need any more details than that. The sin is described. Somebody asked me earlier, when there's a case of sexual immorality, how many details should the innocent spouse know? I think that's sufficient right there. All the other details that are in novels or Hollywood or whatever tend to be unprofitable. He committed the sin of adultery with this woman. That's what you need to know, not all the details, which would just be hurtful. Now, there's not a denial, although there's no description of the ecstasies they enjoyed or anything like that, but the Bible doesn't deny, like in Proverbs 5, 6, and 7, that immorality generates very short-term pleasure. Afterwards, he sends her home. There's also, you know, well, what about Bathsheba? The story, especially in the parallel with Nathan's story, portrays her a little bit as the helpless ewe lamb, that she was overpowered. I don't think she was raped, however. There's no evidence of that. She should have refused, shouldn't she? Some women will find themselves in the place of Bathsheba where they're on a date with some guy and he's coming on to them. What are you supposed to do? Well, one is dressed modestly. Bathsheba didn't exactly follow that. But as well, in Deuteronomy 22, in the law of God, it said that a woman, when a man would come to a woman trying to have sex with her when they weren't married to each other, what was she supposed to do? She's supposed to cry out. She's supposed to try to force him to stop. And there's no evidence she did cry out. Interestingly, when Uriah is summoned by David, he is not overpowered by David. When David says, go home, lie with your wife, take it easy, Uriah doesn't give in. He says the ark of Israel and Judah are staying in temporary shelters, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in the open field. Shall I then go down to my house and eat and drink and lie with my wife? By your life and the life of your soul, I will not do this thing. Yay for Uriah. He had the courage, and I think his wife would have done well also. Women need to have courage in these circumstances. It's also kind of ironic that it says after she purified herself, she's good at keeping the ceremonial law, but she's not doing so well at the moral law. Anyway, finally, so sin conceived, lust conceived gives birth to sin. Sin results in death. Verse 5, the woman conceived. She sent and told David, I am pregnant. Interestingly, by the way, this wasn't some great torrid love affair. This is a one-night stand from all we can tell. And yet, out of that came the deadly consequences. Now, one way it should have been death is, according to the law of God, if a man is found with a married woman, they both shall die, is what the law said. Proverbs warns us that the one who commits adultery with a woman is lacking sense. He who would destroy himself does it. Wounds and disgrace he will find, and his reproach will not be blotted out. The conception of a child, which should be an occasion of great joy and thankfulness as a gift from God, in this case, is a tragedy. And we're not going to read the rest of the chapter, but David's attempts to cover up his guilt just compound his sin. And this is true, that sin begets more sin. Sexual unfaithfulness leads to a lot of other sin. You could go through basically the Ten Commandments, and David pretty well knocks most all of them out. He lies, he deceives, he has stolen a wife in the end, he murders Uriah, he coveted his neighbor's wife. He also involves others. He involves his servants in the act to begin with, the cover-up. And ultimately, you keep reading. The rest of 2 Samuel is a tragedy when you see what happens with David's children and David's household, when you see even the life of Solomon and his uncontrolled desires towards women. It leaves a tragic legacy. So what do you learn from this? Watch out. Be careful if you think you stand, lest you fall. You could think, can't you reach some level of holiness where you're walking with the Lord so closely that this couldn't happen to you? No. David wrote Psalms. David was the man after God's own heart. None of us has ever been like David was to that degree. And yet if we neglect our souls, this can happen. How we need to guard our hearts, guard our eyes, flee youthful lusts. Protect our thoughts. And a really important lesson is, don't think that you can toy with sin without experiencing the consequences. One of the outlines we're not going to go through in detail, the audio is online if you want to listen to it, is called The Pain of Porn. And a problem with lustful thoughts, and it could be mental porn or it can be looking at porn, is lust is never satisfied. Lust always wants more. And I think with sin, and it could be the sin of, by the way, anger, bitterness, fear, covetousness, we think we can manage it. We've got this monster. We think we can keep it small and keep it in a cage, but it's going to grow really fast. And sooner or later, the man who has been looking at the swimsuit pictures on the sports page will no longer be satisfied by swimsuit pictures, and he's going to want to see more and more and more. And soon he's not going to be satisfied with pictures, and he's going to be going off to a strip club or finding a prostitute or having an affair. That's the dangerous picture James paints, that if you are allowing a sin in your heart to continue, it's going to grow, and it's going to give birth not to a beautiful 8-pound little girl, but to a hideous monster that will kill you. And it's very dangerous, and that's why I've used a strong language. If lust has been conceived, what must you do? You must abort it. And even late-term abortions are allowable in this case. I'm using deliberately shocking language. That this sin will kill you. It will destroy you. Again, no excuse for a literal abortion of a real baby. But the picture here, and again, same thing. A woman is allowing bitterness to rage in her soul, and she's bitter against her husband, and she's cold towards her husband, and she allows it to grow and to grow and to grow, and she doesn't deal with it in a godly way, either through forgiving and moving on or confronting in a biblical way. And as that sinful desire grows in her heart, it's going to have awful impact on her marriage and on her relationship with her husband. Anger as well. Any kind of sin will kill you. That sinful desires produce sinful acts. And, of course, then positively, how important it is to nurture our own relationship with God. That even if you were walking with God and greatly used of Him 2 years ago, it's possible, if it could happen today, that it could happen to you, to drift to a place of vulnerability. Another lesson, this is also very practical for counselees, is stay busy fulfilling the calling God has given you. I had a counselee who came to me, and when he was supposed to be at work, and he was a private contractor, so he just worked for himself when he had work, and he would tell his wife he was going off to work, but instead he was going to the casino where he was gambling, and in addition to gambling, he was also drinking. So obviously gambling addiction, drinking, those are sinful patterns. But if he'd been doing his job, he wouldn't have been doing that. So to be busy and idleness is very, very dangerous. One thing I can't quite figure out is summer vacation for kids. Is that a good thing for a 16-year-old, 15-year-old to have nothing to do for 3 months with the television and the internet and all the temptations that exist in our culture, or just hanging out, to be busy fulfilling your calling, because idleness is destructive. I think it was Matthew Henry said, the bed of sloth is the bed of lust. To be busy in the home, in your church, in your vocation. Obviously, to guard your marriage in terms of sexual sin, not just the sexual part of your marriage, but the closeness and the intimacy. I don't think David ever really got the kind of personal love and intimacy that a man and a wife ought to have. I don't think you can do that when you've got a bunch of wives. But to have the oneness of person, and then, yes, to find joy in each other, expressing that love. And then you would say to the person who's single, you too need to guard your marriage, which we hope is in the future, by not doing things now that you will have to confess you will regret and could keep you from being with the person he would like to be with. And then back to flee youthful lust. Jesus uses radical language too. If your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out. To do whatever it takes to abort the sin. In practical terms, many people who are dabbling with sin, lust conceived, think they can handle it on their own. That, again, concrete example, had a guy who was actually a deacon in his local church, not ours, who was going to strip clubs and getting lap dances from the strippers there. And his conscience was troubled, and he came to me. But he was really convinced that if I just gave him some good advice, he could handle it, that he could stop this. And part of my answer was, well, I can tell you this. If you tell your wife and you tell your pastor, you're going to get a lot of help. If you're really serious about stopping this, and I believe your wife has a right to know since you've been violating your marriage vow in a significant way, but if you really are determined to kill the sin, you know, it's not a matter of starving the dragon, it's a matter of killing the dragon. And as long as this secret thing is going on and you don't have the accountability you need, you know, if you're serious about it, don't just put a patch on the eye, pluck it out, Jesus says. Take radical action. Seek accountability. And then there is hope. There is hope for sinners. That Psalm 32, Psalm 51, where David confesses his own sin, he says, "And you forgave the guilt of my sin," that the Lord did restore David by God's grace. And those, even if you've fallen into the sin, that because the Son of David, Jesus, has come, not as David who was a king who ended up taking, but a king who gave his life, that through Christ, those who confess their sin can be justly forgiven. And one of the most important things about studying a chapter like this, I think one reason it's in the Bible, is when you see David, and up until now, David was kind of your greatest hope ever that there'd be a true man who could really be worthy to lead the people of God, and yet he failed. It makes you thankful for Christ, who was tempted to every possible degree, never sinned, never failed. Where David failed to keep the covenant, Christ has perfectly kept the covenant for his people. And now our guilt has been laid upon him, and the demands of the law have been satisfied by his death for us. But also the righteousness that each one of us lacks has been imputed to us because he kept covenant. He kept God's law for us, and he is the king who is worthy, the king who saves his people, and the king who has set us free. Back to what we talked about in terms of sanctification. David didn't have to do this, and we don't have to do this. That because of what Christ has done for us, what Romans 6 describes is that the power of sin has been broken over us. And we have the power in Christ when we have a sinful desire to abort it. As our old self, has, you know, we consider ourselves to be dead to sin but alive to God in Christ. Our old self has truly died with Christ and we are new in Him. And this doesn't have to be repeated in our lives.